I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect, it is 1:37 p.m. on Wednesday, April 21st, 2021. Present in the room today are Representative Thompson, Representative Carpenter, Representative Lavon, Representative Edgman, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Rasmussen, Representative Josephson, Representative Johnson, and myself, Co-Chair Merrick. This afternoon, we will hear introductions of House Bill 41, Shellfish Projects, Hatcheries, Fees, by Representative Ortiz, House Bill 47, Council for Alaska Native Languages, by Representative Story, House Bill 127, Muni Bond Bank, UA Loan and Bond Limits, by Representative Lebon. So we will begin today with House Bill 41. Representative Ortiz and his staff, Liz Harbold, are here. If you would like to put yourselves on the record, come on up to the table and begin your introduction.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair Merrick, members of the Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Dan Ortiz. I represent District 36, Southern Southeast Alaska.
And thank you, good afternoon. My name is Liz Harpold, and I am staff to Representative Ortiz.
Again, thank you, Madam, our co-chairs Foster and Merrick, for giving us the opportunity to present to this body House Bill 41. Madam Co-Chair, this bill should be familiar to every member of this committee. It's a bill that's been around for at least one session, if not two sessions prior, and it's one that all of you who have voted on, with the exception of Representative Johnson, voted out of committee last year. It's an important bill, Madam Co-Chair. It serves as an opportunity to jumpstart another potential key area of our economy, and in this case, to help expand our already important fishing industry in a new area. The bill is an enhancement of Alaska shellfish industry, holds the potential of expanded economic opportunities in Alaska's coastal communities, and increased resilience of the state's fisheries portfolio. To tap this potential, House Bill 41 allows qualified nonprofits to pursue enhancement and/or restoration projects involving shellfish species, including red and blue king crab, sea cucumber, abalone, and razor clams. This bill, Madam Co-Chair, creates the regulatory framework with which the Department of Fish and Game can manage shellfish enhancement projects and outlines criteria for issuance of permits. It sets out stringent safety standards to ensure sustainability and the health of existing natural stocks. The Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game must also make a determination of substantial public benefit before a project can proceed. In addition, Madam Co-Chair, the bill allows the Department of Fish and Game to set the application fee for a shellfish enhancement project permit and grants the similar authority over the application fee for a salmon enhancement project permit. This bill also amends statutes governing the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute to allow ASME to market aquatic farm products, including oysters and kelp. Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 41 plays an important role in the development of mariculture in Alaska by providing a method to increase the available harvest of shellfish for public use in an environmentally safe and responsible manner. And with that, Madam Co-Chair, I would ask that you allow Liz Harpold to add a few more comments about the bill itself.
Yes, thank you. Ms. Harpold.
Thank you again for the record, Liz Harpold, staff to Representative Ortiz. As my boss explained, this is a bill that many of you have heard before. It provides the legal framework for fish and game to permit and regulate shellfish hatcheries. They're mirrored off of our salmon hatchery statutes that have been around for decades. And this is something that was brought forward to us by different members of the industry and stakeholders that are interested in this. So this has been a very well vetted, well thought out tool that members of the industry have brought forward for fishing game to have. To back up a little bit and to take a few words from Julie Decker, who has been a big champion for this bill, who is unfortunately unable to participate in public testimony today since she's traveling, I want to explain a little bit about what mariculture is. There's a few parts to mariculture. There's farming, which currently exists for like oysters and kelp around Alaska. It's a private business, and we currently have statutes that allow for this to happen. This bill doesn't touch that other than opening up ASME's statutes to allow for them to market aquatic farm products. What this bill mostly pertains to is the enhancement and restoration of stocks of shellfish, which is for the public benefit. So if somebody were to have a fishing license, whether it's subsistence, sport, commercial, to fish an area, the idea is that they'd be able to restore enhanced stocks of shellfish in these areas. There have been instances around the state of depleted shellfish stocks, such as crab out west, or even certain shellfish in southeast due to predation. There are a few groups out there that are working on research on how to better enhance these stocks or restore these stocks, and providing this framework for fish and game to regulate and permit them is the next step in that process. And we have somebody online from one of these groups who will be part of the invited testimony a little bit, and she'll be able to speak at much greater length to that. And so just to wrap up, again, like my boss said, this is a great bill, and we're very excited and, you know, fortunate to be able to bring it forward to the House Finance Committee today. And with that, I'd be happy to walk through sectional if the committee wishes.
Yes, thank you.
The sectional for House Bill 41, Version B, which is Bill Number 32-LS0291, Section 1 provides the Alaska Board of Fisheries the authority to direct the department to manage production of enhanced shellfish stocks beyond broodstock needs for cost recovery harvest. I also want to point out that any broodstock that's going to be used within Alaska is a native species to Alaska, so there will be no outside species brought in for this purpose. Section 2 grants the Department of Fish and Game the authority to set fees for new private nonprofit salmon hatcheries based on regulatory costs. This is the only section that changes salmon hatchery statutes, which that $100 application fee was last set in 1974. So they want to have the ability to set a application fee that better reflects the cost of administering that application. Section 3 is conforming language consistent with other fee structures set and adjusted by regulation, requiring fees to approximately reflect the cost of administering the application process and to be reviewed and adjusted periodically. Section 4, and this is the meat of the bill, and it's mirrored off of the salmon hatchery or salmon enhancement statutes that I talked about earlier. It adds a new Chapter 12 to Title 16, Shellfish Stock Enhancement Projects. AS 161210 provides direction to the Commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game on issuance of permits for private nonprofit shellfish fishery enhancement projects and grants the department the authority to set the permit application fee. It states the permit fee will be accounted for separately as non-general fund program receipts. This section directs the Commissioner to consult with technical experts in the relevant areas before permit issuance. AS 161220 provides for a hearing and public notification and input process prior to issuance of a permit. AS 161230 describes terms and conditions for permit holders to conduct their work, including cost recovery fisheries, harvest, sale, and release of enhancement project produced shellfish, and selection of broodstock sources. AS 161240 describes the revocation process should a permit holder fail to comply with the terms and conditions of the permit. AS 161250 specifies that shellfish produced under an improved enhancement project are a common property resource with provision for special harvest areas by permit holders. This section also provides the Board of Fisheries to establish regulations relating to this chapter. AS 161260 directs the department to advise and assist permit holders in their planning, operations, and construction of facilities to a reasonable and appropriate extent. AS 161270 provides the department the authority to approve source and number of shellfish taken for use as broodstock. AS 161280 places restrictions on how monies received from sale of shellfish may be used only for operating costs associated with their facilities. AS 161290 relates to cost recovery fisheries and provides a means by which a shellfish hatchery may contract to either harvest and sell shellfish or to implement a self-assessment from amongst its membership for purposes of recovering operational costs associated with a hatchery. AS 1612-100 gives the department authority to inspect facilities at any time while the facility is in operation. AS 1612-110 requires the permit holder to submit an annual report to the department. AS 1612-199 provides the definitions for facility, genetically modified shellfish, and shellfish. Section 4-5 provides the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission authority to issue special harvest area entry permits to holders of private nonprofit enhancement project permits. Section 6 defines legal fishing gear for special harvest area entry permit holders. Sections 7 through 10 are the statute, or are the sections related to the ASME language in our bill. Section 7 adds marketing and promotion of aquatic farm products to the powers and duties of the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. Section 8 is a conforming amendment which prohibits ASME from promoting aquatic farm products not from Alaska, a specific region of Alaska, or by a specific brand name. Section 9 is again a conforming amendment. Section 10 utilizes the existing definition of aquatic farm products. Section 11 exempts shellfish raised in private nonprofit shellfish project from the definition of farmed fish. Section 12 makes application fee revenues received by the Department of Fish and Game from the salmon hatchery and shellfish hatchery programs be accounted for separately. Appropriations from those program receipts are not made from the unrestricted general revenue fund. Section 13 establishes state corporate income tax exemption for a nonprofit corporation holding a shellfish fishery enhancement permit. Section 14 is a technical conforming amendment required from legislative legal by prior session law and has no impact on the policy set forth in this bill. Section 15 exempts shellfish harvested under a special harvest area entry permit from seafood development taxes. Section 16 establishes an effective date for the salmon hatchery permit application fee described in Section 2 of this bill. Section 17 authorizes the Department of Fish and Game to adopt implementing regulations. Section 18 establishes an immediate effective date for Section 17 of this bill pursuant to AS1.10.70C. And Section 19 establishes an effective date for Section 14 of this bill. And that concludes my sectional. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Harbold. Are there questions? Seeing none, we will move to invited testimony. First up is Sam Raybung, Commercial Fisheries Division Director at the Department of Fish and Game. Mr. Raybung, if you would please place yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me to be here. For the record, I'm Sam Raybung. I'm sorry, there's a tremendous amount of echo and I can't hear myself.
We're hearing you clearly.
Okay, I'll try it again. Thank you for inviting me to be here. For the record, I'm Sam Raybung, Director of the Division of Commercial Fisheries, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I'm also a member of the Governor's Mariculture Task Force, which was established in 2016 by former Governor Walker and reinstated and extended by Governor Dunleavy. The ADF&G mission statement says we are to protect, maintain, and improve the fish, game, and aquatic plant resources of the state and manage their use and development in the best interest of the economy and the well-being of the people of the state, consistent with the sustained yield principle. Alaska Statute 1605092 says in part, the department shall encourage the investment by private enterprise in the technological development and economic utilization of the fisheries resources, and through rehabilitation, enhancement, and development programs, do all things necessary to ensure perpetual and increasing production and use of the food resources of the state waters and continental shelf areas. the work described in that statute was previously under the purview of the Fisheries Rehabilitation Enhancement and Development Division, or FRED, of ADF&G until 1994, when FRED Division was merged with the Division of Commercial Fisheries. With FRED Division gone, the department no longer conducts fishery restoration, rehabilitation, or enhancement projects other than the Division of Sportfish Hatcheries and Stocking Program. The Division of Commercial Fisheries still operates the pathology, gene conservation, and mark tag and age labs, and has contracted out the operation of the FRED Division salmon hatcheries to private nonprofit aquaculture associations who operate them at their own expense as a service to the common property users. We provide permitting and oversight through our statewide aquaculture planning and permitting section here in Juneau in the ADF&G headquarters. The section is responsible for the salmon hatchery program, the aquatic farming program, and for permitting of research and educational projects statewide. Since both aquatic farming and fishery enhancement are addressed within HB 41, I'll try to explain the differences, which are significant. Currently in Alaska, mariculture is limited to aquatic farming, which means a facility that grows, farms, or cultivates aquatic farm products in captivity or under positive control. Aquatic farm product is considered private property, just as livestock is on a land-based farm. Aquatic farming primarily benefits the private owners of that farm and business. In contrast, the other form of mariculture is fishery enhancement. This entails the restoration, rehabilitation, or enhancement of natural production. This benefits the common property fisheries these organisms are harvested in, the subsistence, personal use, sport, and commercial fisheries, rather than private ownership. And this is what would be allowed if HB 41 becomes law. For your reference, restoration means restoring a stock to a location where it has been extirpated and no longer exists, and bringing it back to a level that can be naturally produced and sustained. Once achieved, the project ceases. Rehabilitation means assisting a poorly performing stock to recover to its former level that can be naturally produced and sustained. Once achieved, the project ceases. An enhancement means producing additional numbers of naturally producing stock above what it can produce in nature in order to provide additional harvestable surplus. If the project ceases, the supplemental harvest production goes away, production of the stock reverts back to what can be naturally produced and sustained. One example of a mariculture restoration project is the Alaska King Crab Research Rehabilitation and Biology Program, or ACCRAB. This program seeks to plant juvenile king crab from nearby stocks into locations that supported these stocks until the 1980s when they were overfished and have not yet recovered, even with 40 or more years of fishery closures. The only tool the ADF&G has at this time is to keep those fisheries closed. With the passage of HB 41, there will be another tool we could try. Some examples of a mariculture rehabilitation project are collecting adult razor clams from the east side of Pook Inlet, inducing them to spawn in a hatchery, and planting the juveniles back onto those same beaches where the parents came from. This could increase recruitment into the fishery and help that stock recover more quickly. This could also be done for hard shell clams that have diminished in Kachemak Bay due to overharvest and sea otter depredation. Another rehabilitation project could be collecting and aggregating abalone in Southeast Alaska in order to increase their density and spawning success. There's an awful lot of types of projects, and there's not a one-size-fits-all, so I'm just hitting a few of the prime examples. So an example of a mariculture-enhanced project, which is primarily what this bill is about, is backstocking sea cucumber juveniles immediately following a dive fishery, which typically occur on about a three-year rotation here in Southeast Alaska. Increasing the number of juveniles will potentially increase recruitment in the fishery and provide for increased harvest or maybe even a quicker rotation. This could also be done for other species such as gooey duck, king crab, etc., to increase the numbers available for harvest. And also, targeting enhanced stocks can be a way of reducing harvest pressure on other natural stocks and allowing those to rebound and increase in numbers. And we've seen that happen with some of our salmon fishery enhancement programs as well. So passage of a law to allow restoration, rehabilitation, and enhancement of shellfish stocks is one of the priorities identified in the Alaska Mariculture Task Force's Mariculture Development Plan. Like with our Salmon Fishery Enhancement Program, if HB 41 passes, this work will be subject to pathology, genetic, and management oversight from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Alaska already has the most stringent aquaculture guidance in the world, and it's held up as the example of how to do it right in a manner that minimizes negative effects on natural production and maintains the sustainability of natural production for the fisheries and people who depend on it. And that will not change. And I'm confident that we have the tools needed to address concerns and to permit projects to operate in a precautionary manner. And with that, I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Raybong. Are there questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony today. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Next up is Jeremy Woodrow, president of the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. Mr. Woodrow, welcome to House Finance. If you could place yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, thank you, co-chairs American Foster and Vice Chair Ortiz and members of the House Finance Committee for the opportunity to speak with you today. For the record, my name is Jeremy Woodrow, and I'm the executive director for the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, also known as ASME. The Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute is established in statute as a public-private partnership to foster the economic development of Alaska seafood resources. It plays a key role in positioning the Alaska seafood industry as a competitive, market-driven food production industry and functions as a brand manager of the Alaska seafood family of brands. Recognizing mariculture as an emerging maritime industry with tremendous opportunity for Alaska's coastal economies, ASME supports HB 41. Mariculture involves cultivating marine organisms in the ocean for food and other products such as oysters, mussels, abalone, gooey duck, as well as seaweed such as kelp. The practice does not require feed, fertilizers, insecticides, herbicides, or antibiotics, making it sustainable and inexpensive. Because of its economic and environmental promise, the Alaska Mariculture Task Force has identified the goal to build Alaska's mariculture production into a $100 million per year industry over the next 20 years. In order to increase jobs and economic opportunity for fishermen and Alaskan businesses, the ASME Board of Directors unanimously supports HB 41 and legislative action to allow the marketing of mariculture products or aquatic farm products as defined in Alaska Statute 1640-199, which ASME is currently prohibited from doing so. It is joined in support of this bill by the Alaska Seafood Industry, the Alaska Mariculture Task Force, and the Alaska Shellfish Growers Association, as well as many new Alaskan-owned and operated businesses. Not only does mariculture present a significant economic opportunity for Alaska, it offers the ability for seafood companies to diversify their existing product portfolios. With the support and efforts of the Mariculture Task Force, small family businesses have already proven products to be commercially viable by selling boutique products while offering fishermen opportunities to utilize their vessels, equipment, and skills during shoulder seasons. If passed, ASME plans to include mariculture products in its effective and lucrative consumer, retail, food service, and food aid marketing programs in domestic and targeted foreign markets. In efforts to ramp up this burgeoning industry, ASME will lend the same expertise and outreach to the mariculture industry that it has to Alaska's seafood industry for the last 40 years. Thank you for recognizing the value of Alaska's maritime economy and for your consideration of this meaningful legislation to aid economic development across Alaska's coastal communities. I'm also available for questions should you have any. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Woodrow. We appreciate your testimony. Are there questions? Seeing none, it's good to talk to you. We will move on to our next testifier, Heather McCarty, Chair of the Mariculture Task Force. Ms. McCarty, welcome to House Finance. If you could please place yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This is Heather McCarty. I am the chairman of the Mariculture Task Force, the Governor's Mariculture Task Force. I'm also the co-chair with Dr. Ginny Eckert of the ACRAB project, which is something you heard described by Sam Raybong just a minute ago, Alaska King Crab Research, Rehabilitation, and Biology Program. And I also work for Central Bering Sea Fishermen's Association, which is the CDQ group on St. Paul Island in the Pribilof. As you've also heard, the history of House Bill 41 is a long one, and it was a proposal that came from the great need to to put together a set of regulations and allow shellfish enhancement in hatcheries for the purpose of increasing or enhancing those particular species. The Mariculture Task Force has prioritized solving problems and removing impediments that prevent the development of mariculture in Alaska. And we have identified several priorities, two of which are dealt with in House Bill 41. One of them, of course, is the putting together of those regulations that allow for shellfish enhancement hatcheries. And one of them is the allowing of marketing of species produced by mariculture by the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. So there's two main pieces of this bill, and both of those pieces were made priorities by the Mariculture Task Force. The Central Bering Sea Fishermen's Association, the CDQ group that I work with, has a great deal of interest in shellfish mariculture. And the reason is because up until about 40 years ago, the early 80s, there was a very viable stock of Pribilof Island blue king crab surrounding the islands, and it provided a great economic benefit to the city of St. Paul. It was processed there, and it provided a great fishery for a number of crab vessels, and then it was gone, and it hasn't come back. As Mr. Rayburn described, the only tool that the Department of Fish and Game has is to not allow commercial fisheries of that species. There was also a similar situation in the Gulf with red king crab around Kodiak, which at one time was an enormous economic driver of that community. And in the early 80s, again, those stocks dried up, and there was no more crab, and they haven't come back, even though they haven't been fished for that long. So the Alaska King Crab Research, Rehabilitation, and Biology Program was put together by folks from the Pribilofs and the rest of some of the other communities in the Bering Sea, including St. George and St. Paul, and by folks from Kodiak area who were interested in trying to rehabilitate that king crab stock there. And it's basically been in existence for about 15 years. It's been a decade and a half of research into what drives the crab life cycle. And the next step, now that we've mastered the technology and the techniques of rearing crab in captivity, the next step is to have larger production of crabs so that they can be released into the wild and potentially rehabilitate those two crab stocks. That technology is also transferable to other crab species and other king crab as well, some of which are not in particularly good shape in Alaska right now. I think you're going to hear from Dr. Eckert about some of that. So I guess what I'd like to let you know today is the depth of support for this bill from the king crab research folks, the Central Bering Sea CDQ group, the Mariculture Task Force, and many other crab folks in the business who are hoping for rehabilitation of crab stocks. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have about the need for this bill and the importance as well of the marketing portion, both of which I think are extremely important to the advancement of mariculture and the marketing of mariculture products out of Alaska. Great opportunities for communities in all of coastal Alaska. Thank you for the opportunity and for the work on this and for hearing it today. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. McCarty. We appreciate your testimony. Are there questions? Seeing none, thank you so much for joining us today. And finally, is the co-chair of the Steering Committee for the Alaska King Crab Research, Rehabilitation, and Biology Program, Ginny Eckert. Dr. Eckert, welcome to House Finance. Please place yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you. Wonderful. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks. My name is Ginny Eckert. As was mentioned, I'm a fisheries professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm also the director at Alaska Sea Grant. I've worked in Alaska since 2000 on a variety of different shellfish questions and have worked in a lot of different shellfish fisheries. As was mentioned, I've also served as the science director for the Alaska King Crab Research Rehabilitation and Biology Program. So I want to thank you for hearing this bill. I've testified on this bill in support of this bill for many years, but I want to sort of speak to the sort of biology and the need for rehabilitation of shellfish. So shellfish are these fishery resources that we've talked about already here, crabs, clams, abalone. Many of these species have declined in abundance. They're important fishery resources. King crab are native to Alaska. They're iconic to Alaska, for example, as are resources like abalone. Many of these fisheries have declined for a variety of different reasons. Many king crab stocks in the Gulf of Alaska crashed in the early 1980s, and they have not recovered, as you've already heard. We think that these crab stocks in particular crashed because of overfishing, and this was done a long time ago in the 60s and the 70s. We didn't understand fisheries as well as we do now. There were also foreign fleets, and so we're pretty convinced that overfishing was the cause of the decline. So these populations have been depressed so low that they haven't been able to recover on their own. So rehabilitation is a path forward to help these stocks to recover. So in the last decade or so, my colleagues and I have published over 30 biological publications specifically looking at king crab, trying to understand the biology, the early life histories, the genetics, and so forth. So we've done the science to sort of understand how this could move forward in a responsible way. So our research reveals that the king crab are not recruiting on their own. And so that means there are not new animals showing up. We think that there is this bottleneck, that the population is struggling to recover on its own. And so outplanting animals to the wild, we've done on an experimental scale, and it has been very successful. So we've been able to recover animals up to a year later that we've put out, and these animals that we've put out are really super tiny. So the ability to recover them is just amazing. There are genetic concerns, of course, with any of this kind of work, and we've done the genetic work to better understand the genetics in the wild of what is existing and to understand how appropriately we could culture these genetically to alleviate and minimize any genetic impacts on wild stocks. So this bill, I've talked about king crab, this bill will apply to other species as well. Another species that I've done work on with some of my graduate students is abalone. We've gone to traditional harvest sites where abalone used to be abundant. We surveyed 17 sites, and we didn't find abalone at 13 of those sites. So here's another species that has been depleted. There were commercial fisheries, once again, a long time ago, in the early 80s and so forth, that depleted these before we sort of understood the biology of them. And there's potential there to do active restoration. So in the state of Washington, there are restoration efforts on the same species of abalone that are well supported, they're well managed, and that kind of model could be implemented in Alaska. But this bill is needed to move forward with any of these kinds of restoration projects. So I thank you, and I'm available to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Dr. Eckert. Are there questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you for being with us today. We appreciate it. And that will end our invited testimony, and we will move to public testimony. I will open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify on House Bill 41, Shellfish Projects, Hatcheries, Fees? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony. Now we'll have the departments go through the fiscal notes. The first one is fiscal note number one, OMB component 393. And we have, again, Mr. Woodrow, president of the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. Mr. Woodrow, please place yourself back on the record and explain your fiscal note.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jeremy Woodrow. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Seafood Market Institute. We do not anticipate there being any fiscal note attached to this piece of legislation for ASME, so therefore it's a zero fiscal note.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Woodrow? Seeing none, thank you for joining us today. Next will be fiscal note number two, OMB component 471, as well as fiscal note number 3, OMB component number 2965, from the Department of Fish and Game. Mr. Raybung, are you available to go over these fiscal notes?
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Sam Raybung, Director of Commercial Fisheries Division, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We have a zero fiscal note for this bill. The Commercial Fisheries Division intends to utilize existing staff in our aquaculture section to administer this program. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions on component 2 or 3 fiscal notes? Okay. Thank you for being here, Mr. Raven. Next, we will move on to fiscal note number 4, OMB component number 3251. And I believe we have Kyle Scherer online from the Office of Management and Budget. Mr. Scherer, welcome to House Finance. Could you please place yourself on the record and explain your fiscal note?
Yes, thank you. For the record, Kyle Scherer, Office of Management and Budget. Because the revenue impact is indeterminate, the appropriation to the hatchery permit holder is also indeterminate, which is reflected in this note.
Thank you. Are there questions for OMB? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Scherer. We appreciate you being here. And finally, we have fiscal note number 5, OMB component 2476 by the Department of Revenue. We have Chris Becker, Auditor, Tax Division, online. Please state your name. Oh, hi. Please state your name and go over the fiscal note.
For the record, this is Chris Becker with the State of Alaska Tax Division, and I'm an auditor. Through the chair, for the revenue impact, it cannot be determined at this time because we don't know the number of hatcheries and fishermen that would participate. And for the implementation cost, it would not require material changes. So that's a zero note.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. Are there questions? Thank you for being with us today. Are there any questions from the committee regarding House Bill 41? Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're rushing right along. I got the impression that you're going to try to move this bill today.
Yes.
I'd like to object to that. I've never seen a bill move through here that didn't have two hearings. I have an amendment being drafted at the present time. I could stumble through doing a conceptual amendment, but it wouldn't be quite as good as it should be.
But we will hold the bill and wait for your amendment.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, we will set this bill aside and hear it at the next hearing. Thank you, Representative Ortiz and Ms. Harville. Next, we will hear House Bill 47, Council for Alaska Native Languages, by Representative Story. Welcome, Representative Story, to House Finance. You could place yourself on the record and begin your introduction.
Thank you, Chair Merrick and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, I am Andy Story, representing District 34, which is on Occoquan land, and the indigenous language of the area is Tlingit. House Bill 47 came about as the Alaska Native Languages Preservation and Advisory Council wants to do two things. One, shorten the council name, and two, expand its membership. The council provides recommendations and advice to both the governor and legislature on programs, policies, and projects, and networks and advocates in support of the council's mission. The mission is to advocate for the survival and revitalization of Alaska Native languages through collaboration and sharing. The Alaska Native Language Preservation Advisory Council was created by the second session of the 27th legislature. The governor appointed 5 voting members who are professional language experts and who represent diverse regions of the state. Additionally, there are 2 non-voting members, one member of the Senate, appointed by the Senate President, and one member of the House appointed by the Speaker. I have been fortunate to serve as that member, the non-voting member from the House, and this is how the information came to me. The two seemingly small changes proposed in House Bill 47 have significant meaning to the Council. The first item in the name change simplifies the name from the Alaska Native Language Preservation and Advisory Council to Council for Alaska Native Languages. This reflects the goal of sustaining and reinvigorating Alaska Native language, a concept that goes beyond preservation. The second change requested is to add two new members, going from 5 members to 7 voting members. Alaska has about 23 distinct native languages, and to be able to be inclusive of more cultural regions, the Council feels 2 more voting members would capture a greater perspective. House Bill 47 has a $10,000 fiscal note. I was surprised to find the fiscal note. It was explained to me that it's a placeholder. The Council typically makes 2 trips a year. In 2015, they moved to 1 trip, and they have not taken a trip since 2018, as there's been a freeze on travel. I do want to note that Sandra Mueller from the Department of Community, Commerce, and Economic Development is online with an explanation on the fiscal note. And then, Chair Merrick, depending on the wishes of the committee, my staff, Mary Perezuk, is available to walk through the sectional analysis, which is very short, as this is a simple bill. And importantly, there is an invited testifier, Kune Twitchell, online, who is a voting member of the Council and a longtime Indigenous language advocate. And he is ready and willing to speak to you. And we are all happy to take any questions.
Are there questions for Representative Story? Seeing none, if your staff is available to go over the sectional, that would be great.
Good afternoon, Waka.
Good afternoon. We can hear you well.
Wonderful. Chair Merrick, members of the committee, I appreciate you taking the time to hear House Bill 47. The sectional analysis before you is quite short and simple. Section 1 amends AS 44.33.520 for the name, the Council for Alaska Language and Preservation and Advisory Council to Council for Alaska Native Languages, as Representative Story just presented. Section 2 amends AS 44.33.520C by changing voting members from 5 to 7, and that is the completion of the sectional analysis. Chair Merrick, thank you. Thank if you have any questions, I'm available.
Thank you, Ms. Aperiza. There's no questions.
Boyana.
I see no questions from the committee, so we are going to move on to invited testimony. First, we have Dr. Hune Lance Twitchell, Associate Professor of Alaska Native Languages at the University of Alaska Southeast and a member of the Alaska Native Language Preservation and Advisory Council. Dr. Twitchell, welcome to House Finance. If you could place yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Honorable Representatives, and thank you, Chair Merrick. My name is Hune Lance Twitchell, and I represent myself here today speaking in favor of this bill and hopeful that increased budget allocations can be made towards Alaska Native languages. It is an honor to visit with you here today and to talk about the sacred and irreplaceable languages of Alaska. I teach language revitalization and the Tlingit language at the University of Alaska Southeast, and advocate for the health and safety of the 23 Alaska Native languages. I'm the Vice Chair of the Alaska Native Language Preservation and Advisory Council and a co-chair of the Alaska Native Studies Council, though I do not speak for those organizations here today. I wish I could tell you that there was good news regarding Alaska Native languages. I wish I could tell you that since we declared a state of emergency for our languages, that sufficient work had been done and changes were made that led to hope. That is simply not the case. We declared an emergency and then simply moved on. I will tell you what is going to happen on your watch if we do not adjust our focus and priorities to include Alaska Native languages at a high level. Half of the surviving Alaska Native languages are going to be lost, quite possibly forever. The silence will be horrifying. There is so much work to do and so much loss on a daily basis, and that work falls upon six people from the perspective of the state of Alaska, the five council members and the single employee of the Alaska Native Language Preservation and Advisory Council. When this council was formed in 2012, many of us doing this work felt a charge of energy. We felt seen and heard, but then politics began to be played. The staff positions for the council were cut from one to two. The reports produced every 2 years often fell on ears that refused to listen and eyes that refused to read. If Alaska Native languages were important to the state, then this Congress would have heard the calls for change and taken more substantial action since that time. We had at least 23 languages that were spoken in this state at the time of contact, and 21 of them are still spoken today. But by my estimations, over half of them likely have fewer than 10 speakers remaining, and we are still only talking about incremental changes. Our state is only towing a line that keeps our languages in a death spiral. And I'll tell you this, if this was your future on the line, if this was a total break between your present existence and all of your ancestors, and if you stood to lose the chance to pass along your identity to your descendants, I would do all that I could to help you. This is the way of the human being. So I'll ask, can you, not as a single representative, not as a committee, not as a House of Representatives, but as the legislature of this great state of Alaska, could you collectively say that we have done the same? This is a small change that the council has been asking for since our last report came out 2 years ago. We are not in the business of preservation. We need substantial and lasting change that leads to revitalization. What kind of leaders are we if we allow entire ways of knowing to be eradicated by systemic and deliberate genocide? What kind of humans are we if we stand upon a foundation of exclusion based on race that results in the loss of languages that are tens of thousands of years old? Can we, with steadfast determination and unity, dream of a future other than death? Can we find the courage to create a different destiny? To this, I would say, yes. This is a small change, and as a scholar and advocate of language revitalization, I have ideas for larger changes, such as a College of Alaska Native Languages within the University of Alaska, an Alaska Native Language Schools Consortium that operates in partnership with the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development, an Alaska Native Language Media Network, and inclusion of Alaska Native languages in state standards of education. For now, I implore you to grow this council and find a way to elevate the voices that are burdened with this tremendous work. Give it a stronger and more relevant name regarding the work that we do and the terminology currently used in our field. Our work is not in preservation, but in revitalization. I preserve my traditional foods, but I work to revitalize and stabilize our indigenous languages. We're doing all we can to stop the tide with our bare hands, from which this government has removed the tools and the populace. Have courage, leaders. A brighter future calls you if you choose to listen. A new day is waiting if you choose to see. In our language, we say gunshish. Thank you. I am available for questions as well.
Thank you, Dr. Twitchell. We appreciate your perspective on this. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Dr. Twitchell, thanks for your statement. What kind of resources would the, I think you mentioned just about a minute ago, three or four ideas beyond the scope of the bill for language preservation? For example, the College of Indigenous Languages. Do you have any idea what kind of resources that would require?
Thank you, and through the chair, I believe for now it would involve a rearrangement of existing resources, and then we can analyze. Like if we want to teach all of languages and do so without charging tuition, and that would be a future sort of move to look at. But for now, I don't think there would be a significant cost to create the College of Alaska Native Languages, because we have folks who are teaching these languages already, but we just do so without any specified degree program and no clear direction to create teachers. So I don't think it would take a significant increase in resources at this time, although if we wanted to dedicate a staff to bolster the Alaska Native Language Center, which has gone through, at the University of Alaska, typically when people retire now, they just don't get replaced, especially if they're teaching something that's a marginalized program. But if we were to bolster the Alaska Native Language Center to be able to produce high-quality publications and language documentation, I think that would certainly push things in the right direction. The other things would, I think, an Alaska Native Media Network take some funding and some initial startup funds, and there's some folks that I've been talking about doing that through public radio and broadcasting through Alaska Native Languages, building momentum onto that and creating a central office that produces audio and video content and helps to broadcast those throughout the state, which have been highly effective in Hawaii and New Zealand for Hawaiian and Maori languages.
Thank you. Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Dr. Twitchell. We appreciate you being here today. Next,
thank you.
Thank you. Yes, next we have Sandra Muller, Director of the Division of Community and Regional Affairs, and she's online to speak to the fiscal note. Ms. Muller, if you could state your name and put yourself on the record and give us an overview of this fiscal note.
Yes, good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. I am Sandra Muller. I am the Director of the Division of Community and Regional Affairs. The language program is housed within DCRA. There is not a separate budget for this program. It is folded in within the DCRA total budget. And the fiscal note does represent two staff traveling two times for a total amount of $10,000. So that's the essence of the fiscal note, and I can try to answer any questions you might have.
Are there questions regarding the fiscal note?
Yes.
Representative Edgman.
So, hi, Sandra. Good to hear from you. Two staff traveling. I thought there was just one staff of the council. Did I not hear that correctly?
I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Edgman, it was two council members. My apologies.
Two council members, but there is just one staff. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, it is.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Muller. Mm-hmm. Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Merrick. I just wanted to, if possible, address Representative Edgman's question a little bit better.
Yes, Representative Story.
Thank you. And maybe I just wanted to clarify that for adding the two new voting members, that is the additional cost for those two members to travel if the council does begin traveling again.
Thank you.
Quick question, if I may.
Yes, Representative Edgman.
And did I hear right that the council hasn't traveled since 2018? Is that what I heard earlier?
Follow up to that?
Yes.
In 2015, they switched from two trips a year to one, and then in 2018, they have not traveled since then.
Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, Representative Story, thank you for being with us today.
And if I might, Chair Merrick.
Oh, yes, please.
Thank you. I'm very honored to serve as a non-voting member of this council. And in your packet, I had meant to mention that their report from 2020 is included. And on page 18 of that report, their findings and recommendations of the council are there, and it's very interesting reading, and I encourage you to make sure that those two pages, for sure, you have had an opportunity to learn about the work of the council and their recommendations to us.
Thank you. We appreciate that, Representative Story. And we will set House Bill 47 aside for now, and we'll take it up at another hearing. I'm going to take a brief at ease to change presenters. Brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. Finally on our agenda today is an introduction of House Bill 127, Muni Bond Bank, UA Loan, and Bond Limits by Representative LeBon. His staff, Amy Bushnell, is here as well. Welcome. Representative LeBon, please place yourself on the record and begin your introduction.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Finance Committee, for hearing House Bill 127. And for those committee members that served last year in this on this committee, this is going to be a deja vu moment because I did present this a year ago, but I'm happy to do so again. I will go over a brief summary, and then I'll have my staffer, Amy, go over some additional information. She'll fill in the gaps because usually I miss something. Do the sectionals and clean up after me, if you will. House Bill 127, Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority, does several things. One, it affords access to regional health organizations to the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank at up to 100% of the project cost. Now, there are project limitations and total funding limitations that Ms. Bushnell will cover with you in her part of the presentation. The second purpose behind this bill is to afford access by the University of Alaska to the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank to give the university an opportunity to refinance debt or take out new debt, if be that the case, if they can improve their debt service condition and take advantage of that opportunity. So in a nutshell, that's the purpose, to afford access by regional housing authorities to the Municipal Bond Bank and to afford access by the University of Alaska on debt to the Municipal Bond Bank.
Thank you, Representative. Ms. Bushnell?
Hi, Amy Bushnell, staff to Representative LeBon for the record. In House Bill 127, there are three sections. The first section, it removes the project scope limitation of only heating or energy projects for the University of Alaska. Section 2 removes the 49% project participation for the Municipal Bond Bank for Regional Health Organization projects and raises the project limit for a single project to $250 million. Project 3 raises the cap for the university projects to $500 million, and it raises the cap for all Regional Health Organization projects to $500 million. The difference in the two numbers there for regional health organizations is that in Section 2, it is only for one project, and in Section 3, it is for all regional health organization projects that the bond bank may participate in. I believe online we also have Mr. Devin Mitchell. He is executive director of the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank. Luke Wells is available, as well as Myron Dosh, the chief finance officer for the University of Alaska Fairbanks, University of Alaska.
Great, thank you, and we appreciate that you're representing your Nanooks here today. Okay, so we will move to invited testimony, and up first will be Mr. Devin Mitchell, Executive Director of the Municipal Bond Bank Authority. Mr. Mitchell, welcome back to House Finance. Please place yourself on the record and begin your testimony. Mr. Mitchell?
Yes, can you?
Yes, we can hear
Sorry,
you now.
I think I had a technical issue there.
Well, we can hear you now. Please go ahead.
Great. And thanks for the compliment earlier. For the record, Devin Mitchell, I'm here today in my capacity as the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority. And I think the bill's sponsor and staff have done a great job of describing what the bill does. The bond bank organization is supportive of the proposed legislation, and that's demonstrated by myself stating it, as well as the chairman of the bond bank board, Luke Wells, being available for questions. And to the extent you had any questions about the bond bank program or the potential impacts of the changes to the statute, were both available.
I do think it's important just to note that the purpose of the change isn't to increase the use of debt in the state of Alaska. It's really just to make debt that otherwise is going to be issued more affordable. And that's the essence of the bond bank program in all of the bonds that it, or all of the loans that it participates in. At this point, we have about $1.1 billion in loans outstanding through the program. The portion that's currently outstanding for regional health organizations is about $144 million. That issuance of, or I'm sorry, that was the amount that we've issued since the program's inception. And of that amount, as a result of that issuance, it's estimated that we saved the Alaskans that use those facilities $65.3 million. And so I think that is a recognition of the strength of the program and the benefit that it can provide. And with that, if there were any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Yes, thank you. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, for you, Mr. Mitchell, you said that the purpose of the bill is not to increase bonded indebtedness, but the bill does increase the potential for bonded indebtedness, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, my statement was intended to mean that the debt is going to be issued in either case. So if there's a project that's been vetted and is in a phase of development that it's going to be financed, that's going to happen whether it's financed with participation of the bond bank or not. So the bond bank's participating is really just a means of providing alternatives to other financial mechanisms and reduce costs that otherwise would be borne in all instances of bond bank lending by residents of the state of Alaska.
Follow up?
Should committee members, Mr. Mitchell, through the chair, be concerned at all with the crowding out of other opportunities for bonded indebtedness due to the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the support that the state provides to the bond bank program has been utilized to reduce the cost of borrowing. It has not ever been utilized to actually pay the debt service of the bonds issued by the bond bank. The underlying borrowers have paid all debt service since the program's inception in 1975. And so when rating analysts are looking at the bond bank program, they're aware that the states provided certain support for the program, but they don't count it against the capacity of the state to otherwise issue debt for other needed capital projects.
Follow up? Through the chair, Mr. Mitchell, is the reason for the reliability of this bond bank authority because of the scrutiny paid to the proposals? I mean, you described 45 years of history that sounds outstanding. What do you account for that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think that you've hit the nail on the head. There's a rigorous credit review process that's required both before a project ever comes to the bond bank, as well as once the bond bank is brought into the financing process. So initially a project, if it were a community project, has to be vetted by the local elected officials, then if it's going to be supported by a general obligation pledge, or in some instances even a revenue pledge, it requires a vote of the local residents to affirm that they are supportive of the project and the issuance of the debt. And then that entity applies to the bond bank for a loan, and the loan is first vetted by the financial advisor of the bond bank, which is a third-party nationally recognized financial advisory firm that goes through a process of analyzing the credit features of the proposed loan, and that they make a recommendation in each of their analysis. That analysis and recommendation is then provided to our board of directors. We have a 5-member board of directors, 3 members from the general public, and 2 commissioners, and that board has to approve the proposed loan as well. And so if a loan hasn't met a certain standard, or if it's a speculative type of undertaking, the process would not allow it to reach fruition, reach the point of a loan being provided to that particular borrower's request.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Edgman.
So just a quick question, Devin. I see that the bill basically has sort of 2 disparate elements. So one is for the university and the other is for regional health organization. Is this basically a sort of a cleanup bill where you've got 2 entities putting into one bill because it fits on the same subject matter?
Through the chair, Representative Vegman, yes, that's again correct. That when the regional health organization authority was created back in 2016, the or 2015, the 2016 was the first loan. There was concern that was a new line of lending for the bond bank program, and there was a lack of knowledge about the regional health organizations and the financial strength and kind of integration into the very fabric of healthcare in the state of Alaska, that in many, many communities throughout the state, the only healthcare that's going to be available is going to be that which is provided by a regional health organization. And so as a result of the newness of the program and the lack of information and knowledge about the existing regional health organizations, there were some limitations placed into statute that make our program inefficient in its implementation, and we're cleaning those up now that we have some experience and have learned about the financial strength of the regional health organization community in the state. It made sense to do that. And at the same time, the University of Alaska, a couple of years ago, received some fairly serious or significant, I should say, credit rating downgrades while going through the process of the state struggling with the operating budget reductions. And as a result, there was one authorization specific to the university that existed within the bond bank program, and that was for a power heating project on the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus, that it occurred to bond bank staff and the board that it would make sense to allow the university the opportunity to apply to the bond bank on a more broad basis, if it made financial sense for them to do so. So it just is allowing both regional health organizations and the university the opportunity, not the right, but the opportunity to use the bond bank if they have good projects and are able to demonstrate that their programs are sufficient to provide for the repayment.
Follow up?
Well, just as a concluding comment, I think this also speaks, as Representative Foster would agree, I think that to the economic power of the Alaska Native healthcare system and the regional health organizations themselves. And if I remember right, for the university, this is a presentation made from earlier this year, their bond debt payments, I think their debt service was about $28 million, $30 million a year, something like that, mm-hmm. which is still pretty reasonable in comparison to their overall budget of, was it $700 million, whatever the federal state combination was. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. Representative Wool.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I do remember this bill presentation from last year. I can't say I can recall it all 100%. A lot of this stuff is a little Greek to me, but I remember the issue of the $500 million cap for the university. and I remember, I what's the total debt? I guess the idea is to refinance and bundle certain debt instruments into the lower interest ones from the bond bank. And where's the number $500 million come from?
Mr. Mitchell?
Through the chair, Representative, well, the number would include the potential of the university refinancing outstanding debt through the bond bank. That was much more of a likelihood last year than it is today, because I believe the university has gone through a refinancing on their own to take advantage of low interest rates and bonds that were currently callable. But it really is intended just to be a not to exceed amount that would provide for any potential existing or future need of the university. And remember, the university has to have any larger bond issuance that they might consider issuing approved by the legislature. And so this isn't, again, even if you ignore the fairly rigorous financial analytical process for being eligible for the bond bank program that I described earlier, the university has its own checks and balances in place to that limit the ability of the university to issue new money debt.
Follow up.
Thank you for that answer, Mr. Mitchell. And I remember when they built the power plant, of which a portion of it was bonded, a much larger portion, I believe, was paid from the state, and it was only when they couldn't get the final money to finish the project that the university had to bond for it. And there's a sentence in the sponsor statement: this additional financing tool is not intended to be a substitute for capital appropriation. But I guess I could envision, if the university has this capacity, this cap of $500 million, if they wanted or needed another major capital project, the legislature could just say, well, just bond for it. You guys have the capacity for that. And maybe this to the bill sponsor, how do we know that wouldn't happen, that the legislature might say, you know what, you guys, you have good credit, or you have access to these funds, just go borrow it. And there may be a time and a place for that, but also there may not be.
Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Representative Woe, the university is going to seek the best deal it could find. If it goes on its own and seeks funding through a bond issuance, it could do that. Working with the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank, if that was to its advantage financially, it could now do that. And then, as of course, if we wanted to appropriate money through a capital budget, they would be most certainly happy for that option. So you can look at it that it just gives them one additional financing option.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So the borrower, if the borrower doesn't go to the bond bank, mm-hmm. what are the other options that the borrower would have? And I think we just heard a couple of them here. One of them is a bond. Another one would be another financial institution, I guess. So the question is, what are the alternatives if they're not going, for example, the University of Alaska? If it doesn't go to the bond bank, what are its other alternatives?
Representative LeBon.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question. The options are somewhat limited, because in a traditional banking sense, for a bank to loan money on a university property would be an unusual condition. I'm not saying that they couldn't pursue that type of financing. That would be unusual, because a bank is obligated to seek collateral and secure the loan, and pledging a building on a campus of the university as collateral would probably be a problem, I would get. Maybe Mr. Mitchell would want to weigh in on that too. So in my 42 years of banking, I never made a loan to a public education institute. Now, the regional health organization part of that question, that's possible for a bank to finance that type of a facility, but probably would only do so with government participation through Bureau of Indian Affairs on a guarantee program, or USDA on a guarantee program, or maybe participate with ADA on a program. So for a bank to do all of the financing would be real unusual in any of either of those two cases.
Follow up?
On a different subject or a different question line here, this removes the project scope limiting the bond bank authority participation to only heating and energy projects, and I'm wondering why it was limited to those two projects in the first place.
Representative LeBon.
Mr. Dosh is on the line, I believe.
Mr. Dosh, can you place yourself on the record and help Representative Carpenter?
Through the chair, this is Myron Dosh, Chief Finance Officer for the University of Alaska. Correct. The original bill was just limited to the heating project for the Fairbanks power plant. And at the time, it was really just a part of a larger financing package that included, you know, bonds to the bond bank, as well as cash appropriations, state appropriations for the power plant. So at conception, I believe it was just related to, you know, if you will, accomplishing that project at the time. And now, as Mr. Mitchell stated, it's envisioned to provide additional opportunity to the university for other financing or new projects or refinancing obligations. So from a university's perspective, we support this bill really because it provides an opportunity for a bottom line savings that's really created in getting a better interest rate on our debt through the bond bank than we might otherwise receive on our own. I did want to add on, just following the discussion, that, you know, the university, we have the authorization to issue debt, and we take that, you know, we take that seriously, but it goes through a rigorous process, and, you know, including looking at the mission, you know, any project's relationship to our mission, you know, the need, all that due diligence, a business plan, the ability to pay any loan back. So really we're doing that thinking and analysis on any project, really irrespective of this bond bank, you know, bill. It's just, if we were at the point of refinancing or issuing new debt, we would consider, you know, going through the bond bank or going to the market, the university itself. Again, within, as was mentioned earlier, state statute authority for larger projects that the university would consider. So again, I'm happy to answer any question as it relates to the university, but we do support this bill. Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. So just a follow-up to your answer, and thank you for the detail. You had said something about interest rates these would be better than interest rates you get elsewhere, and that you might go to the market. What does that mean? Where else would be giving you interest rates that wouldn't be as competitive as the bond bank, and what is the market that you're referring to?
Right, the difference in the interest rates and the kind of the deal, if you will, that one would receive comes about because of the credit rating of the bond bank versus the credit rating of the university. And to the extent that the credit rating of the bond bank is better than the university, that margin in the credit rating would provide, generally speaking, all things, you know, other things equal, a better interest rate. So that answers, I think, that part of the question. As far as the market, I mean the general bond market, like the capital markets where bonds are bought and sold through an underwriter, through a negotiated deal. So when I speak of the market, I speak of the general bond market for bond issuances.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, for either of the invited testifiers, does under House Bill 127, the legislature must sign off on that part of the bill that concerns the University of Alaska, but not that part of the bill that includes the regional health organizations? Is that correct?
Mr. Dosh, are you able to answer that?
I would defer that to Mr. Mitchell.
Sounds good. Mr. Mitchell.
Yes, so again, Devin Mitchell, Executive Director of the Alaska Bond Bank, and through the chair, Representative Josephson, the regional health organizations don't have to go through any state process. They're created under state law, but they don't have to go through an additional state process to issue bonds, nor do other borrowers that use the bond bank, which the list would be municipalities, joint action agencies, and joint insurance associations.
Okay, follow up. Is there a requirement where the annual debt service would be increased over $2.5 million that the legislature would have to sign off on that increase?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that's a requirement that's unique to the university system. And maybe at the beginning I should have given a bit of background just on how the bond bank works, that the bond bank enters into loan agreements with underlying borrowers in which the bond bank agrees to purchase the loan, if you will, or the bonds issued by that underlying borrower on a private placement basis, meaning the bond bank is the only purchaser. The bond bank, to fund that loan, issues in the municipal market that Myron referred to earlier, bonds that are issued in $5,000 blocks and purchased by investors. And so the bond bank is if there was a requirement of an underlying borrower to seek legislative authority for a loan, that would be part of the process that the underlying borrower would take on, not the bond bank.
Follow up?
Yes. So thank you. So Mr. Mitchell, there is a requirement for new indebtedness exceeding $2.5 million of legislative approval in the context of the University of Alaska's borrowing. Because I don't see, I mean, I'd love to see where that is in the bill, and it's not jumping out at me.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that's not in this bill. That's an existing requirement for the university.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mitchell, while we have you online, are you prepared to go over the fiscal note?
Sure.
Thank you.
And so the fiscal note is based on an assumption that there would be a series of issuances by regional health organizations or the university through the bond bank over the coming years in an estimated amount of $100 million a year. And if that were to occur, then there would be estimated costs of approximately $360,000 per year, the bulk of which would be for services associated directly with the issuance of the bonds. So things like paying our financial advisor, our bond counsel firm for crafting the documents and providing an opinion on the bonds, validity, rating agency costs, et cetera. Those costs would be paid by receipts of the bond bank typically when we sell bonds, there's a cost of issuance account that's funded that is used to pay for the cost of issuing the bonds, and so these costs would actually be paid out of proceeds of the bonds that would be issued to make the loans to the communities and incorporated as part of the interest rate or yield that they would pay on the loan that they achieved through the bond bank. Otherwise, the fiscal note describes the changes to the statutes that were already provided to the committee by Representative LeBron and his staff.
Thank you. Are there any questions on the fiscal note? Representative Edgman.
Yeah, not a question, but just maybe at the risk of being redundant here, fiscal notes generally don't show cost savings. I think it's implied here that by the actions of this bill, there would actually be cost savings for the institutions involved. So I just wanted to put that on the record.
Mr. Mitchell, would you like to comment on that?
Through the chair, Madam Chair, that's actually an excellent point that, as I stated earlier, the entire purpose of the bond bank program is to save money. And the only reason why, whether it's communities, regional health organizations, the university, or other authorized borrowers come to the bond bank rather than going directly to the municipal market is because they're going to save money by using the bond bank. And so even though we have these costs, they're more than offset by savings that are achieved by obtaining lower interest rates on the loans or bonds that are issued that don't flow through the bond bank, but they flow to the organization that is providing services or capital projects that provide for need in the state of Alaska.
Thank you for that. And we will finish up with our final testifier, Myron Dosh, again, Chief Financial Officer for the University of Alaska. Please place yourself back on the record and you can begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. Myron Dosh, Chief Finance Officer for the University of Alaska. I really didn't have anything additional to say. My comments were incorporated into earlier responding to the question. I would just summarize it by saying, you know, the university does support this bill. And happy if there is any additional questions I could answer. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, again for another attempt here. Totally sounds good that we can save some money on refinancing. The fiscal note here is the second paragraph that talks about the possibility of default and that the legislature and the governor be asked to pay the debt service. I'm curious if the full faith and credit of the state is on the hook here, including the permanent fund itself. Would it be obligated to whatever dollar figure is necessary?
Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have a third testifier on the line or not?
There is Luke Wells.
Could we bring Mr. Wells on?
Okay, he was noted just having to answer questions, but we would love
to
hear from
him. I think he could give some cash flow repayment insight on the bonds for a regional health organization. Thank you.
That sounds great. Mr. Wells, please place yourself on the record and help Representative Carpenter with his question.
Sure. This is Luke Wells. I'm the chairman of the bond bank and also, I work for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. I've been in tribal health for 20 years as a CFO with out in Bethel at YK and up in Barrow at ASNA. So I can be glad to answer a few questions if you have any in regards to the regional health organizations in the state.
Representative LeBron.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe go over for the committee, Mr. Wells, the repayment source, how the bond sales are underwritten, and how the regional health organizations stand by the debt.
Sure. So in regards to the most recent one, the new hospital out in Bethel with the Yukon-Kuskokwim Healthcare Corporation, they entered into what's called the joint venture agreement with the Indian Health Service. that they would be responsible for building the facility. And once the so the cost of the facility is on the organization. Now, in that situation, there's a partnership with one of the federal entities to help with funding on one half of it, the bond banks on the other half of it. And once the facility is built, then the regional health organization receives what's called a staffing package from the Indian Health Service, which pays not only for the staffing to cover the new staffing needs in the facility into perpetuity, but it also has a what's called contract support costs that's allocated that will help cover the payment, and actually in all cases will cover all the payments for the bonds. And just for information for everyone, whenever a tribal member receives care, medical care, regardless of the type, behavioral health, dental, primary medical, then, and they receive their care at a regional health organization, a tribal health facility, then if they're on Medicaid, that cost is reimbursed to the state at 100% from the feds. It's 100% FMAP instead of the otherwise 50% FMAP if they receive care at another organization in the state that is not part of the tribal health system. So it's in the state's best interest to financially to see that all the tribal members on Medicaid are definitely receiving their care in the tribal health facilities throughout the state.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So I think what the picture that's being painted is that we're relatively sure that we're going to continue to having revenue. The sources of revenue are going to remain, and therefore a risk of default is low. But my question is, if there is something unforeseen and there is a default and the legislature and the governor are asked to pay the debt service, then what exactly does that mean? Is that just an appropriation of UGF, or unforeseen circumstances we would be required to tap into the permanent fund to pay that, depending on the size of the obligation?
Representative LeBond. Yes.
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Mitchell would be best suited to answer that question.
Thank you. Mr. Mitchell.
For the record, Devin Mitchell, Executive Director of the Bond Bank, again, and through the Chair, Representative Carpenter, the response would be absolutely not. The permanent fund would not be pledged to the Bond Bank credit in any way, shape, or form. The moral obligation is a term of art that's recognized in public finance, where you have a statutory framework that requires you fund a reserve securing the bonds, and then there's a reporting requirement on that reserve to the legislative body and governor on an annual basis. And if it were deficient, the issuer would request a replenishment of that reserve. It's something that any legislature could decide wasn't in the state's best interest to fund. There would be potential ramifications as a result of that decision, but there's absolutely not a requirement that it be made.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell, and thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Representative LeBond and Ms. Bushnell. We appreciate you presenting today, and we will take this up at another hearing. So with that, this concludes our agenda for today. Our next meeting is tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., where we will hear House Bill 28, Exemption for Registration of Boats, and then continue the presentation by the Department of Natural Resources on House Bill 81, Oil and Gas Net Profit Share Lease Modifications. So with that, at 3:12, we are adjourned. Thank you.